Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point, and welcome to part two of our pop-up mini-series on capitalism and its discontents. Yesterday, we looked at one slice of the history of American capitalism. Benjamin Applebaum talked to us about the 50-year influence that free market economists have had on U.S. policymakers.
They urged policymakers to focus on maximizing growth and to set aside a concern for redistribution or equality of opportunity. And they argued basically that that would be okay, that as long as everyone was benefiting, it shouldn't matter if some people were benefiting more.
Granted, and as mentioned, this is just one slice of the story of the vast global transformation that took place in the latter half of the 20th century. But Applebaum also noted that here we are, well into the 21st century, and some economists, including some Nobel Prize winners, stand by the growth at all costs is good for everyone theory of the world. That to think about issues of inequality, some of those same economists say, would actually be poisonous. And Applebaum said that has to change.
The problem we are confronting is inequality. And so the solution is to make inequality, reducing inequality, a focus of public policy. That it sounds simple, but it's something we simply haven't done for the last 40 years.
So what about for the next 40 years? Well, this hour on Point, part two of our pop-up series, we're going to ask what is the future of global capitalism? And you can join us. How do you propose to bridge the inequality gaps within global capitalism? What would you change in how capitalism functions? Or do you think we ought to ditch the system altogether? Or do you think it's working just fine, that inequality is part of capitalism and it's required for the system's success? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, today for part two of our little mini-series, we're joined by Branko Milanovic. He's with us from Paris, France. He's one of the leading economists at work right now studying inequality. He's former lead economist at the World Bank's Research Department. He's now at the Stone Center on Socioeconomic Inequality at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And he's author of the new book, which comes out a little later this month. It's called Capitalism Alone: The Future of the System That Rules the World. Branko Milanovic, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be there.
So first of all, let me just ask you simply, is inequality required for capitalism to work?
Let me answer this question by saying first, yes, indeed it is absolutely required. But secondly, I have to also qualify that by saying that many people actually, when they ask that question, imagine that inequality is some kind of a binary variable, which means either you have inequality or you don't have inequality. The reality, of course, is much more complex. You should think of inequality like the way that you measure, for example, temperature or weight and so on. It's a continuous variable. So the question that we have to ask, is inequality that we have now actually bad for growth and bad for social stability and bad for basically what we call economics intergenerational equality, in other words, equality of opportunity. So let me just say it again. I think it is bad for growth, it is bad for social stability, and it is bad for equality of chances or equality of opportunity.
Mm. And to your point, there are many types of inequality, right? There's inequality of wealth, which is where most of the conversation lies. There's inequality of health, of well-being, of opportunity, all manner. And you know, I know that you've said in previous interviews before that some kinds of inequality, you know, are they make sense, right? Like within one snapshot of time, a younger person who simply hasn't, you know, been alive
Absolutely.
And at work as long is not going to likely not to be as wealthy as someone older. So I understand that. But what you're saying here more deeply is that the particular forms of inequality we have now and its extremes is is the problem. So is capitalism unchecked, if there are no changes to this system now, as we see it, is it sustainable?
Well, obviously, it's a very difficult question. I do believe, to a large extent, it is sustainable, even if all inequality continue to be the way that they are, unchecked. It is sustainable largely because we don't have a blueprint for an alternative system. However, something being sustainable and something being efficient and something being good are two different things. You can actually have capitalism the way that it functions in South Africa. We don't see immediate sort of revolution, but you can eventually have a revolution. You can have a change. So, you know, the question is this a desirable way for the system to function, that you let things really run away in one direction, which is clearly, I'm not saying unsustainable, but difficult to sustain, and it's inefficient even for growth purposes, and then eventually you end up with either revolution or a disorder or conflicts and so on, or is it more intelligent to actually take stock of the situation as it is and to devise ways in which certain negative elements, significant negative elements brought by inequality, would be kept in check.
Yeah.
And thus, further point on that, this is actually a very similar reaction which happened in the 1930s. You know, people in the 1930s were accused, of course, including FDR, were accused of being socialist, covert socialist, all of that. Keynes was accused of being one as well. But what in reality they wanted to do, and which they did, is actually to make capitalism more sustainable. And that's exactly what I think we should do now.
Yeah. So, Professor Milanovic, I hear you being the economist who doesn't necessarily want to predict the future. Okay. So point taken. But the reason why I ask the sustainability of the system question is that, I mean, to your point, like, people look at patterns. Political, historical, economic patterns over time. And you mentioned the 1930s. Mm-hmm. As you well know, right now, many people, analysts, those of us in the media, et cetera, even, you know, just Americans across the country, are saying the kind of inequality, the depth of inequality we have right now in 2019 very much mirrors that of the Gilded Age. And so what happened then? We had a collapse. We had an economic collapse. So, like, is it useful to look at that kind of pattern to predict the future?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very useful. And actually, if you wish, actually, you can make many similar comparisons. You can even say that worldwide, we have now the situation which resembles, in some ways, the world before 1914. Now, it doesn't mean that the war, you know, is inevitable. Likewise, you can say that within the United States, there are similarities between today and the Gilded Age, as you said. But I think that actually, having learned something from the past, we should actually act now and not let the situation evolve in a way where actually the action would be much costlier in the future.
Okay. So we want to talk with you about, you know, what you've written extensively in your new book, Capitalism Alone, about the future of this system here. But first of all, make the case for us. Why is it that you say that capitalism or its various forms it's basically the only economic system we have worldwide today, and that you believe it is here to stay? Why is that?
Yes, actually, both points are accurate. I mean, at least you have accurately represented them, and I'm actually going to defend them. But, of course, not everybody would agree necessarily. Okay, the first point is that capitalism is really a global system, and I think for the first time in history of mankind, is because if you go back to the previous period of large domination of capitalism, which was then sort of global, that's really, you go back to the period before World War I. But one should remember that in that period, you had large parts of the world which were still basically feudal, not only basically, but really de facto feudal. You had to start really from the earliest one. It's that you had the abolition of serfdom in Central Europe, in Austria-Hungary and the Central Europe, only in 1848. So that was mid-19th century. Then you go to the abolition of serfdom in Russia, 1861. Then you come to the abolition of slavery in the U.S. 1865. It's pretty late. You already have very developed capitalism, but it actually coexists with various other forms, including slavery and feudalism. Then you had abolition of slavery in Brazil only in 1888, and then continuation of feudal relations in India and also parts of Asia all the way into the 20th century. So basically, there was really not a competition, but there was simultaneous presence of different types of production with capitalism. Mm. And then you come to the 1917, where actually you have communist revolution in Russia, which later, of course, spreads to Eastern Europe, to Asia, to obviously China, Vietnam, and elsewhere. So basically then, as we all know, you had competition between the two systems. So it's only after the 89 or let's say 95, whatever year you want to take for the Chinese transformation as well, that we have only one mode of production in the world now. And I think this is a very new development. As I said before, it never existed. And of course, I would be very happy to speak if needed, why I believe that China is a capitalist country, but by all right. objective criteria, it is.
Well, because China and its particular model of capitalism is a big part of this story here. But you just sort of elegantly walked us through, you know, your argument for why you believe, you know, capitalism alone worldwide, yes. as you've written in your book. But why do you think it's here to stay? That's what I'm wondering.
Let me just first say, actually, capitalism alone, I think, is a title that should be pronounced, and I'm not actually sure if I'm pronouncing well, with a slight pause between capitalism, comma, alone. And I think it's not by accident that I introduced that comma, because I think that actually it should give us a little bit of, the ambivalent feeling, because having capitalism alone is a good news, because it has actually been really successful in bringing large groups of people, particularly in Asia, not groups, but actually millions, and to some extent maybe more than a billion people out of poverty. But being alone also means that you can actually let certain negative features that you have go unchecked simply because there is no competition.
Right.
So that was the ambivalence of capitalism.
Well, we are talking today. This is part two of our little pop-up mini-series on capitalism, and we're talking about the future of this system worldwide. And Professor Branko Milanovic joins us today. His new book is Capitalism, Alone. And if, before you think that he's a crusading champion of unchecked capitalism, think again. He's one of the economists who's leading the studies of the impacts of inequality that are born by capitalism. So we'll talk more about that when we come back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Branko Milanovic. He's a professor at the Stone Center on Socioeconomic Inequality at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's one of the leading economists today who's studying inequality. And his new book is Capitalism Alone, the Future of the System That Rules the World. It's out a little later this month, but if you go to onpointradio.org right now, you can take a look at an excerpt of Professor Milanovic's book. And we want to hear from you. What changes do you think should be made to capitalism for it to be a system that benefits everyone? Do you think the system is just fine as it's functioning right now? Or would you throw it all out? Now, Professor Milanovic, before we sort of dive even more deeply into how we might see the future of capitalism, I do want you to explain this sort of framework that you present in the book about the forms of capitalism that we have now. And you sort of simplify it down to two kinds of capitalism. Yeah. So first of all, liberal yes. meritocratic capitalism that we find in the West, in the United States, and perhaps Western Europe as well. What is that? How would you describe it?
Yes. Actually, as you said, I have really two key chapters in the book which deal, one of them, with liberal meritocratic capitalism, where I use basically the United States as a key sort of exemplar of that capitalism. And the other chapter is on China, and it's what is called political capitalism. But let me answer your question about the liberal and meritocratic capitalism. First, you know, I want to say something about terminology. I know that many people are bored by that, but I want to say that the use of meritocratic doesn't mean that something is really great and it's absolutely should not be touched. Meritocratic, in the word that I use, it is actually goes back to John Rawls' terminology, which essentially says that meritocratic means that there are no legal impediments to people achieving certain positions in their life or profession and so on. And really, there are no legal impediments in the United States or practically any other country in the world. Now, there are other impediments which actually come from too high inequality, which don't allow de facto, you know, people from poor environments or for poor backgrounds either to go to the best schools or actually to make right connections or to actually accede to the very high positions in society. But that's why I'm, of course, discussing inequality that is being systematically or generated within liberal capitalism, and why that inequality might lead to the formation of a sort of self-sustaining upper class.
Yeah, so I mean, so that's the point, right? That's the heart of your analysis of the forms of capitalism practiced in quote unquote the West. That the system is built, to put it bluntly, such that the rich get richer, right? Because capital appreciates faster than other forms of wealth generation.
Yes, I think so, actually. I think that there are many sort of signs, and I'm not really dealing with science since I'm an empirical economist. I actually deal with the facts and numbers and empirical evidences, which essentially show that the system, the way it functions today, is generating, and I'll actually give you like two examples, generating really increasing inequality, and that increasing inequality leads to the control of the political process by the rich, and the control of the political process by the rich is really required for the rich to transmit all these advantages, be it through money, financial advantages, or education to their offspring, which then reinforces the dominance of whatever is called that upper class. So I think this is the logic that I see it. High inequality, political control, intergenerational transmission of these advantages.
Okay,
so that's actually the three steps.
So very important there. So right there, though, when political and economic power begin to coalesce or are coalescing, as we're seeing in the United States, and as you said, then we also have a coalescing of influence and power and wealth through marriage and education or access to higher levels of education. And fundamentally, as you say, because the return on capital produces greater wealth or is higher than the growth in wages. I mean, that is the structure of the American system right there that you're talking about right now. So given that, what would you change? How would you tweak it? Where should we look to create systemic drivers for more equality rather than inequality?
You see, I argue there that the drivers which we have used from the 1930s until today, of course, they should continue. And, they, you know, I'm not saying that they should be, you know, dramatically changed. But I think they are not sufficient to deal with the problems that we have now. And the reason why they are not sufficient is because you would actually, for them to be sufficient, you would have to make changes, for example, increasing tax rates extremely highly, in a way which the middle class, I'm not talking about the rich, because obviously the rich would not be very keen to pay high taxes. But the question is actually, can the middle class afford to pay higher taxes than they are paying now? And this is not the case in the United States only, but it's the case in Europe as well, that they actually don't want to pay more. And partly they don't want to pay more because they feel they already taxed enough. And secondly, because they have a skepticism towards the use of that money, which they might not have as much, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. So let me take another example, the role of trade unions, which have been extremely important. But the trade unions are on the decline in practically all Western countries. And you have this ironic situation that the trade unions, which were originally created to fight for the rights of workers against private employers, now really basically fight against the state, because the largest trade unions are actually in education or health and so on. So basically, these instruments, I think, are not sufficient.
But Professor Milanovic, can I just jump in here for a second? Because I'm
I'm
unclear on something. I mean, did you just a minute ago say that the question is, should the middle class be paying more taxes? Because isn't one of the sort of primary or first solutions that people talk about? I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, presidential candidates right now in the United States when it comes to lessening inequality is to increase taxes, not on the middle class, but on the wealthiest, so that some kind of redistribution happens, so that investment can happen in the middle and lower classes.
No, there is no doubt about that. I'm totally in favor of that. I'm just saying that if you have an increase, very high increase in taxes on the top, that alone is not going to give you all the funds that you need to fix infrastructure, to fix public education, to fix health.
I see.
In other words, if there is increase to the tax rates, people talk about tax rates of 70 or 80 or 90%. This is fine. But the question is actually also, what is the threshold? If the threshold is 20 million and you put the tax rate of, 80%, it's not going to generate a sufficient amount of money. So essentially, I'm saying it is okay if you go for the very richest people, but this is, again, not sufficient. So there I bring like two different points, and the two different points are the following. Focus on broadening ownership of financial capital, which is currently extremely concentrated. You said before, and it is true, capital actually grows. I mean, the returns to capital are high, and actually they are much higher for the people who have more capital than people who have very little capital. So if you were to broaden the ownership of capital and make the returns to capital more even so that the rich cannot benefit, only the rich currently benefit for all kinds of tax loopholes that are quite well known. So if you broaden the ownership of capital, in that case, the increase in capital share in total GDP of the country would not be as inequality-inducing as it is now.
So how do you broaden that ownership, though?
I'll tell you that in a minute. But okay. The second point, let me just finish with that second point because it's important, is actually improvement in the quality of public education, because the private education is currently really used as a monopoly tool by the rich to make it so expensive that practically 60% of the population or their children cannot accede to high to university or to best education that exists in the United States and also more and more in Europe. So these are the two axes of action. So one of them is broadening capital ownership. The second one is improvement in public education. Now, to answer your question in 10 seconds, I would just say there are many different ways to do that. You can do it through tax advantages, which, as I said, currently are only enjoyed by the people who have large amounts of capital. You can do it from employee stock ownership plans. You can do it by using inheritance taxation to distribute the funds to everybody. You can do it by creation of sovereign wealth funds whose actually income would be distributed across the board. So there are ways to actually make ordinary people be more capitalistic, if you will, than they are now.
Okay. Well, we have a lot of callers who want to join us, Professor Milanovic. So let me start bringing some of them in, because from all over the country here, we've got Wisconsin, South Dakota, Florida, Georgia. And let's start in Atlanta with Ashley. Ashley, you're on the air with Professor Branko Milanovic. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a comment. I wanted to answer the question. I think that what you're saying is, I believe in what you're saying, and I think that it does take tools. It takes tools. Like they say, you give a man a fishing rod, or, you teach a man a fish, he'll feed himself for life. But I think it does take tools from the privileged world to those of us who are unprivileged to get us to that place. And I think capitalism, really, in order to change the scales of what's happening, is that we need to invite everyone to the table. Oftentimes, minorities, African Americans, brown people don't have a seat at the table. So how are we saying that we're solving the problem that we see across these inequalities when we don't have active seats at the table or active voices at the table? Mm. And I think the reason why we're not at the table is because our lives in our livelihoods, and sometimes even by ourselves, are not valued. Because if they were, then we would see more access. And we know why they're not valued is because, again, we say during the times of slavery was free labor, but now it's just a glass ceiling to a certain economic level that doesn't allow you to rise. So I guess my questions kind of surround, what does it really take? Or how do we really have to present ourselves in order to have those opportunities to rise?
Well, Ashley, thank you for your call. Professor Milanovic, your response for her.
Well, first of all, I totally agree with what Ashley said, and I think actually she said it beautifully and very eloquently. It's essentially, if you have a large percentage of the population, and I don't know, in the U.S., it could easily be up to 30% of the people, and actually even more if you look at the fact that 50% of the population don't even vote in elections. You have people who politically, because they feel dejected, that they feel that actually they are not worthwhile and their opinions are ignored, they don't even participate in the political process. And of course, people who are at the top and who are rich are actually very happy with non-participation. So how can we do it? I think actually political participation is absolutely key. In order to affect these changes, to affect whether what I argued for, or whether higher taxation, or taxation, high inheritance taxation, or any other change, you really need a political participation. So I really think that political participation is key, and that by itself would actually limit this stranglehold that the rich have on the political process. Mm.
But of course, a conversation for another day are all the ways that people are being dissuaded or even blocked from political participation, Professor Milanovic. But that's a conversation for another day. Let's go to Daniel, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to know the professor's thoughts on the idea that capitalism itself can't be sustainable because it's based on perpetual growth. You either have to have more products to sell to more people, and eventually you'll either run out of resources or trash the planet, or you'll run out of people to sell to. It's a system that's going to eventually self-destruct. So why should we not now take some cues from the past and move towards a more socialist system, pick and choose the good parts, leave out the bad parts to build a new system from the ground up instead of waiting for a flashpoint where we've done irreversible harm? Mm.
Okay, Daniel, that's a good question. Let me try to sort of break it into several parts. First of all, I'm very much in favor of, and that's actually what the book says also, I'm very much in favor of a number of features of social democratic systems which still do exist in large parts of Europe. But one should not forget that social democratic systems are also capitalist systems. We use terminology sometimes wrongly, but these are the systems that are based on, you know, production on privately owned capital. Privately owned means of production. They use wage labor and they're decentralized. So I think these features of capitalist system would remain whatever system we choose to have. The question is, should we actually improve the current way that the capitalism system functions? And of course, there I'm in total agreement with you. However, I do also note, and that's a whole chapter on that, that as you were saying before, capitalism might run out of products to sell. But in order not to run out of products, capitalism is now becoming really more powerful in invading our private lives. And we are now using, for example, and we give you the examples of Uber or Airbnb, things which never in the past were capital, were actually things that we could not commercialize. So in that sense, capitalism is creating new products. It is actually even invading willingly, because we are willing actors in that, invading our leisure time, because every minute of leisure now has a very clear cost. So in that sense, I think it is actually more powerful than ever. You know, I disagree. My last point, just one sentence. I disagree with many people who speak of the crisis of capitalism. No, actually, I think it is actually at the apogee, the high point of influence of capitalism now.
Wow. Okay. So let me ask you, though, specifically what parts of some of the European forms of capitalism do you support?
Well, specifically, I think actually, obviously, public education, which is now being eroded in Europe as well, but that public education was absolutely crucial in transforming many of European countries from sort of mid-developed and actual agricultural societies into really very highly developed progressive and innovation strong societies, let alone, of course, the infrastructure which has been produced, very high results in education, especially in health. Actually, as you see now, just simply a comment on that, but obviously when you see the difference in health outcomes between rich countries of Europe and even richer on a per capita basis, United States is actually quite dramatic. It's actually Europe, like France and Spain, have, with Japan, the best outcome in longevity, on life expectancy. So this these are all the aspects that I believe are actually, aspects that one should really emulate and take over from social democratic systems.
Mm. But about life expectancy, just to just pick on a particular detail there, because you mentioned the United States having had great gains. Well, that's maybe true on average. That's yet
no,
another...
No, no, I meant actually Europe has a great gains. But when you compare, for example, France and Spain with the U.S., U.S., despite of having higher income, has much lower results on life expectancy.
Okay, great. Yes, because I was going to say, because it didn't necessarily ring true in the United States, because so many people have had their life expectancy go backwards here in the United States.
Absolutely. It's actually quite a unique feature also that the life expectancy is going backwards for large segments of people.
All right. Well, we have to take a quick break here. We are talking with Professor Branko Milanovic. He is one of the leading economists studying inequality today. He's got a new book out. It's called Capitalism Alone, The Future of the System That Rules the World. This is kind of the second part of our little pop-up mini-series on capitalism. We'll be right back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Branko Milanovic. He is a professor at the City University of New York, one of the leading economists studying inequality in the world today. His new book is Capitalism Alone, The Future of the System That Rules the World. And Professor Milanovic, so many comments coming in online here. We've got Houndcat Mike saying, unchecked capitalism will devour itself. Plains Dealer says capitalism only works if the gains it produces are widely shared. Adam Smith knew that from the get-go. That's what Plains Dealer says. Esteban Fernandez tells us it's clear that capitalism should be abolished and replaced with a more human, environmental-centered system focused on ensuring sustainability and a high quality of life. Now, Professor Milanovic, your book is so rich with detail, we could spend hours about any particular chapter. But I did want to give a minute. I did want to give a minute or two to your explanation of a completely different kind of capitalism that's embodied in China. You call it political capitalism. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, there again, you know, the terminology is not mine. I didn't want to invent, like, you know, titles randomly. But it was from Max Weber, who actually talked of systems which are capitalistic, but where the control of the political sphere is a precondition for economic power. So you notice here a parallelism between the American and the Chinese, to make it very simple, capitalisms. In the American case, you have essentially economic power, which then leads you to the political power. And we see that every day, let alone to the people who are become billionaires and then control the newspapers and then gradually control the political process, give money to the candidates and so on. But notice the direction is from economic power to political power. Well, then you go to China. There, because it's a political capitalism, the direction is different because you first accede to the political power and use that political power to actually enrich your family, friends, and to get shares in the enterprises and so on. So the direction is different. The outcome is similar, but the direction is different. And those who have, of course, become rich without political influence, whether it would be, you know, entrepreneurs that we know, I'm not going to name names, but, you know, people like, you know, Jack Ma. Well, now I'm naming names. They have not reached a position politically, but their power is always circumscribed because it cannot be exercised fully, freely. In other words, the state, if necessary, is sufficiently strong to put an end or stop or to control them, to thwart them in certain intentions. So in that sense, it's a political capitalism. And, I said actually it has, I will finish with that, but it has three features which I believe define it very well. First, it has an efficient administration, which is absolutely necessary for capitalism, which is somewhat bureaucratic. Secondly, it cannot have a rule of law, because otherwise, if you have the rule of law, then you don't have discretionary power. And thirdly, the state has to be autonomous. In other words, the state can decide, as I just say, in some cases, to go after people who actually are troublemakers. Yeah. Economically,
well,
and politically.
In addition to that, as you say, that it's not any better at solving the problem of inequality, right? And so here's the fascinating thing. as you point out in your book, we're living in a time where inequality between nations is shrinking, right? Largely because of the rise of China and other Asian countries.
Right.
We haven't really seen it before happen with this at this rate, this speed. But at the same time, inequality within nations is increasing. Have we ever had the two coincide like that?
No, we never had this particular combination. You know, we have the data from the early 19th century. Actually, they start from 1820, and we can chart really these two types of inequality. And what was happening in the 19th century was that both between inequality was increasing because the Western Europe, North America, and so on became richer, and India and China stayed at the old level of income, and, inequality between nations went up. And inequality within them also went up. But we never had the situation that we have now, that there was a significant decline in between country inequality, mostly due to the Asian growth. And it's not only China, it's also India, Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, and so forth. And on the other hand, inequality within each of those nations, including China, as you mentioned, actually, which now has inequality higher than the U.S. level, inequality in each of them has gone up. Mm. So we never had that particular combination of the two inequalities.
Right. So even as nations are doing things right, everyone seems to be doing everything wrong all at the same time. But let's go to Adam, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Adam, you're on the air.
Hi. It's great to be on Point.
Hello.
I'm just wondering why we can't, this is really astounding that we're having this discussion about the merits of capitalism, and we're even talking about socialism on air right now. I'm wondering why we can't really bring in some of the critiques that were penned by Karl Marx in the 19th century that I think are really important for fully understanding this system and the massive amount of human suffering and inequality that it really produces. And now something that I think that we ought to talk about is that we live in a society, and we should be honest about this, where there are really two classes of people, those who produce, the working class, and those who own, who don't work for a living, the capitalist class. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of the new numbers, right, recently released by Oxfam, that there are 26 billionaires who own as much wealth as 5 billion human beings
right.
on Earth.
So well,
how are we
Adam,
going to really honestly address this?
Yeah, no, I take your point, Adam, and obviously you brought that question to the table. So let's address it, Professor Milanovic. What do you think?
Let me just do it very briefly. I agree with what Adam said actually, and it's not that we cannot talk about Karl Marx. Actually, if you read my book, there is lots of quotes of Marx. Actually, the two people whom I quote the most, actually, I looked at my, index when I finished the book, and this is Adam Smith and Karl Marx. So Marx is quoted, and I think it's actually probably one of the most perceptive critics of capitalism. However, today's capitalism is not the same as capitalism, during Marx's life, which, we're talking about 150 years have, elapsed since that time. And one point that Adam made has really changed now. There are many points which have changed, but one of them, for example, we now have people who are at the same time rich in terms of capital, amount of capital and wealth they own and income which they receive from that wealth without working, but they are also working very hard and they are wage workers, although they may be wage workers as CEO, but it's still labor. So that's something we didn't have in the past. And this seems a good news because we don't have like only capitalists and only workers. However, it is also great. It makes more difficult control of inequality because you have people who are simultaneously rich in terms of salaries which they get and the returns on investment shares, investment income, dividends, and so on. So from the policy perspective, it's harder to deal than if you had only two classes of people. So what I'm saying is basically capitalism today is different from the way the capitalism was 150 years ago.
Okay. So, we've talked about liberal meritocratic capitalism, as it's called, as practiced perhaps in the United States, social democratic capitalism in some European
yes.
countries, political capitalism in China. You also talked briefly about other forms, which I hadn't really heard of very much, and it sort of engaged my mind about this question of what direction capitalism should go. For example, you talk about people's capitalism and egalitarian capitalism. What are those?
You see, I think the direction towards which, if of course one were agree with my sort of analysis and my diagnostics and whatever, I think the direction is what I call people's capitalism. Now, what is people's capitalism? People's capitalism is where the distribution of financial capital is relatively, I'm not saying equal, but it's less unequal than it is now. Nowadays, you have the situation in the U.S., and again, it's not only the U.S. situation, in quite a few other countries, including Sweden. You have essentially 10% of population they owe, which own about 90% of financial assets. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, every increase in the return to capital translates, as I was saying before, into an increase in inequality. Now, assume that you deconcentrate that ownership, as I was saying before, with employee stock ownership plans, greater advantages for the middle class to own things and so on. In that case, you would have more equality in the distribution of assets, in wealth. And in that case, we can talk about what I call people's capitalism. So people's capitalism would be the capitalism where actually the middle class and even some poorer people would have much higher stake in the system through the ownership of assets, in particular financial assets, and obviously housing is one as well. But I particularly focus on the financial assets here. So that would be the definition of people's capitalism.
I see. And you also say that healthcare, free healthcare, education would help the question of intergenerational inequality.
Absolutely. I think that's actually, it's very clear. I mean, for the education is almost by definition, because as I was saying before, so long as the access to the same high quality of education, when I'm saying really quality is very important word there, because when we speak of only access to high education, well, yes, you can access high education to, you know, lower sort of level or maybe lower considered colleges that are of lower level, and then you are not going to have income that you have. It will be actually a fraction of the income that you can make when you go to the colleges or to universities that are considered the best. And if in order to overcome that, you have to actually have ability of the middle class and the poor people to accede or actually to send their children to the colleges that would actually generate very high incomes for them in the future. Mm. Because otherwise, what you end up doing is essentially you reproduce the social structure of today, tomorrow, and after that, the next day, and so on. And basically, you're really stuck with high inequality across generations.
Right. And Professor Milanovic, I'm just thinking about your model of people's capitalism here for another second. And when you're talking about increasing workers' ownership of capital, rather than direct redistribution, which would perhaps make it a little more politically palatable, but you also talk about creating greater tax advantages for the middle class, returning to higher rates of taxation for inheritance. We talked about the funding of public education and healthcare. We probably won't spend much time on this right now, but strictly limited and exclusive public funding of political campaigns. So we've had some folks who called in who wanted to talk about Citizens United in this country. But there's one other idea I really wanted to touch on with you, given the current political mood in the United States. That is this notion of citizenship light, which would end a strict binary division between citizens and non-citizens. What is that, and why would that help with the issue of inequality?
Well, let me first say something about let me just go straight and actually to citizenship.
Just dive right in, please.
I'll go with that, because actually you listed quite a few things that, for example, I wanted to say a few words about the campaign financing, because that's really absolutely crucial. So long as you don't have publicly financed campaigns, you would always have rich people sort of controlling political process.
Well, let's get that. We'll tease people and you'll get them to read the book. How's that? So talk to us about citizenship light. Yeah.
Citizenship light essentially means, and actually I think it is even more relevant for European countries than the U.S., but the citizenship light means that immigrants would actually come to the country only if there are jobs available there, and they would stay for a limited period of time and then be obliged to return to the country of origin.
Sounds like a guest worker program.
Yes, it sounds like a guesswork. And to tell you the truth, I am not a huge fan of that in a priori basis. I think that if we have globalization, globalization by definition should also include free movement of labor internationally, the way that it includes free movement of capital. The problem is that I am faced, and we are all faced, with political rejection and reluctance of the populations in the rich countries to accept unfettered or large migration flows. And we are really faced with the possibility that the U.S. becomes, you know, fortress United States and Europe becomes fortress Europe, which would not be good for either of these two fortresses for the rest of the world. So in order to overcome that, I'm saying, okay, the domestic population wants only limited migration, still allow some migration when people have jobs, because it would be good for those people to actually have these jobs, make money, and send the money, you know, back to their countries, and eventually go back to their countries with sort of technological or other, you know, contact knowledge which they have acquired in the rich world. So this is a sort of a solution which I propose, not because I am in love with it, but because I'm afraid that otherwise the real solution would be what we see currently in the United States, where people are actually forcibly sort of sent back, that you have prisons and so on, or what we see in Europe that is not sufficiently reported. It's really thousands of people who die, you know, trying to cross into Europe.
Yeah. You know, Professor Milanovic, we only have about a minute and a half left here to go. And I just wanted to close by asking you this question, because yesterday when we were talking with Binyamin Applebaum about the profound influence over, you know, the course of 50 years that economists, free market economists, had on thinking, belief, and policymaking, especially in the United States, that sort of helped lead us to this moment now. You know, it's once again a reminder about how big, important ideas really matter. Do you think, I mean, you're one of those economists who's now studying inequality. Is the tide at all shifting amongst economists about the importance of the idea of inequality, the reality of it, of trying to use economic thinking to have a positive impact on that? Is there any change going on there?
Yes, first, I've been studying it for like more than three decades. So it has been, I was around for a while, you know, with that topic. But it was not a popular topic at all. It was, as you said, actually a topic which was totally ignored and left out and really ridiculed even, actually. But it is changing now. And it's changing now because people are really seeing, obviously, with their own eyes, that things are really not working well. And that's why so many people are actually calling you today. So they want to talk about that. So this is changing. And what else is changing is that we have big data now. So we have much more in terms of data than we had 20 or 30 years ago. So young people find this challenging, and they are going to study inequality more than ever.
Well, Branko Milanovic is a professor at City University of New York. He is one of the leading economists studying inequality, and his new book is Capitalism Alone, the Future of the System that Rules the World. Professor Milanovic, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was fun sort of talking with you and the listeners.
Well, folks, if you want more conversations like this, a little another pop-up mini-series on capitalism, let us know. Go to Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio and tell us what you think. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.